Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our ever-expanding exploration of the cultures of consciousness. I don't know about you, but this WikiLeaks thing, it feels weird. What I really pay attention to, or try to pay attention to these days, is not so much the content of particular events that are going down in the media, or the debates, or the opinions. Are you on this side? Should they do this? Should they do that? I mean, you know, of course I'm involved in those questions. We all are. We have to be. But there's another level where it almost feels as if the with a certain events like this, you can kind of feel the structure of reality as it's evolving in our incredibly mediated age. And as more and more media constitute our sense of the world, the events that occur in that space that involve technology, that involve information, that involve real political power, when things happen that are kind of unexpected, that come from a strange angle, it's really quite sort of warping. You can almost feel the way that the world has changed more greatly than we think it has. Even as we experience so much change in our ordinary lives, these kinds of events show us the reality of political power, and not just political power, like who holds the power, but the way that our sense of the world itself is kind of constructed through the way that information is deployed, the way that people claim rights to information, the way that corporations respond to government still. You know, we think of like being in a corporate society, but Joe Lieberman can get on the phone and get a corporation to, you know, look at the terms of service that all of us sign without ever reading all of the time, and can clearly be booted off at any time for something that we've agreed to do that we're not doing. So it's a very strange, very vertiginous kind of experience watching this stuff go down. So I'm actually really happy that we have the guest we have today here in Expanding Mind, KMO of the great podcast Sea Realm, because in all my conversations with this fellow, I've been on his show a number of times and have been tracking him for a while, that he's always good for a conversation, whatever's going down. But some more weirdness, my co-host, Maja Dawu, who I'm just about to introduce, told me that she is in need of a bull.
I really need a bull. You wouldn't think it's that hard to find one in L.A., but I do.
Well, no, tell us, explain your situation. It's fascinating.
Well, I'm putting on a mock, well, not really mock, it's real, but kind of, I mean, obviously we can't really sacrifice someone, but I'm looking for someone to play the part of the bull in a sacrifice that I'm doing on the 21st for the solstice, which is a reenactment of the Apis sacrifice, which is actually at the heart of like every single resurrection story, whether it's Christ or Mithra or Dionysus. It all goes back to the killing of the white bull that then gets resurrected. And I've been trying to find a man to play the part of the bull, and we were trying to get him to be naked, but then you can't show naked men in the city of Los Angeles, which is pretty shocking. Even though you can show all kinds of naked women in a performance, you can't have a naked man. And it's kind of interesting, actually, because that was like an integral part of the ritual, was that, you know, the whole story with Osiris, and then like part of it is in fact surrounding the naked naughty bits of the man, because that gets lost and then he gets resurrected and that part of him is still gone, and it's all this like fertility symbolism and stuff like that. But I'm having a hard time finding my Christ bull figure.
You know, that's a tough thing these days to manifest the archetypal realms. It's, you know, there's a lot of difficulty. But I want to bring on KMO, and I want to start out with one archetypal topic. The last time we spoke about zombies. So I want to bring KMO and talk about zombies a little bit, man. How are you doing?
Hey, Eric. I'm doing pretty well. I'm a little chilly. I'm sitting in the bookstore here at the Eco Village Training Center. It's not a heated building, and it's in the low 20s here.
Oh.
Yep. I took a long walk beforehand, and I went a little further afield than I had intended, so I really had to hoof it to get back here in time, and I'm dressed in layers, and I was really hot. But now I've been sitting here for a few minutes, and I'm not so hot.
Oh, my Lord. It's only going to get more that way. No, you don't have anyone can bring you, like, cups of hot tea or anything?
Well, you know, my servants are on holiday just now.
So tell me about the Eco Village Center. What is it?
The Eco Village Training Center is a little corner of this rather famous hippie ex-commune called The Farm. And it is a place where people can come to learn about permaculture and organic gardening and appropriate technology, alternative building methodologies like cob and straw bale, things like that. It was founded by Albert Bates, who, if you listen to the Sea Realm podcast, you've heard Albert on a number of occasions. He is the author of the Post-Petroleum Survival Guide and Cookbook, and he's got a new book out on biochar. So he's a big name in the sort of climate change and just global stewardship community. And this is his baby.
And what's your relationship with it?
Well, it is basically I am the assistant innkeeper here. But before I came here, there was no assistant innkeeper position, so it's kind of a made-up position. So mainly I'm the podcaster in residence.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, I'm also kind of curious. You know, often when I know I had mentioned that I wanted, well, we will get to zombies, no question about it. But when I start out the conversation, I really like to talk about where people, how they got where they are, and particularly with you because, you know, the podcast is a new medium. It's a very interesting one. It's one of my favorite aspects of the new media world, which in a lot of ways I find kind of hectoring and annoying. And the podcast to me is actually a really rich one. I've stumbled across more things that I didn't expect to find, and there's something kind of intimate about it, but also subversive, but also kind of old-fashioned in a way, and I'm really just curious to hear how, not just, you know, the story of Sea Realm, but just the way that it's kind of changed your life, because you've gotten a lot of feedback from your shows, and the topics you talked about clearly became important in your life. So I would love it if you could tell me a little bit about, you know, a brief arc of your experience with doing the Sea Realm and what started you off, and then where it went, and how it shifted your life.
Well, that is a question that has many potential answers, some of them longer than the time we have available. But I will say, and this basically predates the beginning of the podcast by about 8 years, I worked at Amazon.com early on. I got good stock options, and I left after 2 years, and basically I had enough money to just go and play for a good long time. And I really wanted to be a cartoonist. And even while I was spending hours a day at the drawing board trying to, you know, create a project or a product that people would be interested in paying me to continue producing, I was taking classes. I went and took an in-residence, like 2-week residential course in neuro-linguistic programming, and I was taking voice and articulation classes at a community university sort of setting, and I was doing all of these things that were preparing me to be a podcaster, and yet I had no conscious intention of pursuing that. And in fact, at the time, there was no such thing as a podcast. There was no such thing as an iPod. And yet, basically, all the time that I was pursuing something else, something that never really materialized, I was also preparing myself to do the podcast. And as soon as I learned that podcasts existed, you know, as soon as I learned that there was such a thing as a podcast, it was just a brief countdown before I was doing one. And when I started, I was married, and I was living in Arkansas. And I'm no longer married, and I have since lived in Maryland briefly, and now I live in Tennessee. And I got hooked into some, I don't want to say apocalyptic topics, but certainly some grim topics in terms of peak oil and resource depletion and just the sort of untenability, long-term untenability of our financial system. And I went down the paranoid rabbit hole for a bit, and my wife was not at all interested in going down that rabbit hole with me. And so, you know, I made a great effort to sort of put it all aside and you know, grow up and put on the adult clothing and go off and do an adult job. And one day I got a text message from my wife saying that she had taken the kids and that it was over. And I stuck out the job for a bit longer, but then eventually I just couldn't stand it anymore and I quit. And I went on a speaking tour with Neil Kramer, who is a frequent guest on my podcast, and he talks about more spiritual things than I normally do. And he and I made a kind of a team in that I would talk about the sort of nuts and bolts reasons for realizing that our current existence, while it seems a given, while it seems like it is going to just continue and change gradually, is probably not long for this world. And then he would take over and talk about the sort of the wild side, you know, the more esoteric side, the more spiritual side, and sometimes the more paranoid and conspiratorial side. But he's got such a great way of approaching it that it doesn't debilitate the way, you know, I won't mention any names, but some people who dwell on conspiracy, you know, their narrative can debilitate the reader or the listener and just make them feel powerless and angry and betrayed by society. And Neil doesn't
do
that at all.
Do you feel like there was a specific, I'm just interested because it's totally true and people get really swept up in this kind of downward spiral with all this. Was there something that happened to you that kind of triggered you out of that paranoid, conspiratorial, like fear-mongering place? Can you remember like an event or something that kind of like switched it for you or...
Well, first let me say, hey, Maja, it's nice to meet you.
Hi, nice to meet you, too.
I have kind of a sort of resilient, bubbly, happy personality, and I just can't dwell on the dark side for very long without looking for the glass half-full aspects of it.
Hmm.
And so I don't think I was ever really in any danger of inhabiting that, you know, that really dark narrative permanently. Also, I've got this lifelong habit of adopting a narrative that I really think is appropriate and has got a pretty good beat on the truth, learning all the ins and outs of it, and then turning on it, you know, becoming uncomfortable with it. And when I start to hear an ideology speaking with my voice, then I start looking around for the gaps and the holes and the flaws.
Well, yeah, that's a wonderful way to approach things, particularly in our... I won't even say sort of media-saturated world. I mean, it seems to me that one of the things about, you know, the internet as sort of a general cultural phenomenon is that any sort of zone you get interested in, you can get a lot of feedback and a lot of information very quickly. And one little bit of interest, one stray article, one stray podcast can be a portal into a whole world, and the worlds themselves are just ever more rich and full of self-supporting information, rabbit holes, niches, parallel universes, reality tunnels, you know, all of these phrases that have come from different periods. I mean, I often think of Robert Anton Wilson's idea of the reality tunnel as this kind of self-confirming way of constructing the world. You know, so it's an older idea, but it's so apparent now. It's so right at our fingertips. And so to develop those kinds of skills seem really important, because if you maintain a kind of skeptical irony in the face of all of these exploding worlds of explanation, of data, of reality construction, of possibility, of dystopia, then you don't really move very far and you're kind of frozen. But to get stuck is equally frightening in a lot of ways. So it's almost a kind of constant game of sort of either you can think about it as seduction, or you can think about it as a kind of theater where you like, what would it be like to, you know, really question the information on whatever paranormal activity. Let's really go in, and you find that the discussion on whether or not we can scientifically prove certain kinds of paranormal phenomena is actually incredibly rich and sophisticated and complicated. And there's subtle points where you just becomes very difficult to sustain, you know, conventional mainstream conceptions about how we construct reality. And at the same time, it's not exactly like we're you know, living in the fantasy land where your mind creates anything you want it to happen. But there's these, so you can get completely bound up there, and then you're like, okay, wait, wow, I'm in paranormal land. Okay, hold on a second, hold on. And then you sort of fall out in a way, and then you gain almost more understanding by having been involved in a perspective, in a way of seeing the world, in an obsession, in a political commitment even. And so it's a very strange process that I think a lot of the people that I know and respect the most develop a certain facility to do that. It sounds like you're just sort of a natural that way.
Well, I will certainly pay homage to Robert Anton Wilson. I read him many years ago and took those lessons to heart.
Yeah, I remember one of his, quips that really stuck in my mind was just that subscribe to magazines that have the opposite political point of view that you think you have. And I just always stuck in my mind. So simple, and yet it really is deeply instructive, whether you literally do that or do other versions of it. And even today when it's so easy to hook into alternative opinion streams, I find I have to work on my own to make sure that I keep doing that enough to like shake myself out of whatever reality zone I'm in now. But where are you now?
Where am I?
What world are you moving into or moving away from right now?
Well, just in terms of my physical surroundings, I'm in a period of transition because I've just come from a month on the road. And one really great thing about the podcast is that I've got this network of people that most of whom I haven't met, but they feel like they know me. And if I'm ever in town, they would welcome me to their home. So I just spent really 5 weeks driving around the northeast of this country, and I would take my, follow the directions on the GPS, and it'd say turn left, turn right, join the motorway, and then suddenly I'm parked in somebody's driveway, and I've never been to this person's house before, and I go and I knock on the door, and they open the door, and they're smiling, and they're happy to see me, and, they feel like they know me, and within a few minutes, I feel like I know them. And that's really amazing. But these folks are unlike me in that they have either found a job they can tolerate and they're still plugged into the money economy, or, they're still slugging away even though they're really kind of miserable in their money economy niche. They're still sticking with it. And so they have things like a house and internet connection and things like that. And I've been living in their spaces for the past 5 weeks, really enjoying it. And now I'm back here at the Eco Village Training Center, where we've got kind of sketchy internet and cell phones don't work and the building is really cold and, it's just not quite the level of comfort that I've grown accustomed to. So physically, that's where I am. And, of course, there's a mental aspect to that as well.
Absolutely. But, yeah, that even seems to be one of those affordances of our contemporary era, where I know more and more people who, for whatever reason, necessity, interest, romantic wanderlust, have found their ability to do that more and more. It's more and more available to them, whether it's through internet connections, whether it's through like-minded worlds. That there's a kind of, at the same time that things feel sort of restricted, that opportunities are narrowing, that things are becoming more difficult, and the rawness of the political environmental situation is more apparent, that there are these sort of networks that are forming that enable people to flow in that way. So there's something very kind of optimistic about what your story is, even as, there you are in your cold cabin with your cell phone reception, et cetera. It's still better than having a miserable job.
That it is. I mean, anytime I wanted to, I could cut my hair and put on my good business face and go sit down in an interview and get a job. I just can't really bring myself to even contemplate it.
Well, that's one of the things that I really enjoy about, like, some of the things I do, too, like with lecturing and the lecture circuit, is enjoying seeing the kind of people that show up. And they are people that have, like, these regular jobs, and God bless them, they're the lifeblood of America. I mean, I'll see, like, businessmen and even plumbers and people that work for LADWP, and they're showing up to get this information. And I imagine, like, there's all kinds of people like that across the country that listen to your podcasts, and these kind of people that are so starving for this material and those kind of viewpoints that they can't get access to any other place, and they're living their lives this way. And literally, like, some of the information that we can, for whatever reason, we're able to provide for them is such an inspiration that they're happy enough to, like, do things like open their homes to you, even though you're a total stranger, because you're literally inspiring a part of themselves that gets no attention in any other part of their life.
That is very true and very consistent with my experience.
Yeah, it reminds me, I remember someone telling me about he was like a a wandering Buddhist martial arts kind of guy, and he was from Taiwan, or you know, from China. And what they were amazed about is that the guy, he like lived his life without plans, because he had developed this travel foo, where in addition to just the fact that a lot of people knew about him, or he knew or people knew of, you know, there was a network of folks who would sort of be aware of him, and he could do it. He just had the ability to kind of show up anywhere, and then just it would work out. He'd meet the person who had the extra room or had the thing, and then the thing for a minute, and then he could do the practice for a day or two and get the money to go on. And he just lived, and he just thought he was committed to this life of not having a concept of like what the next move was. And you know, I'm sure sometimes it doesn't work out, but there's a way in which one aspect of our environment with the awareness of the difficulty of people's situation, but also our ability to connect, the kind of suppleness and quickness with which the technology can feed back desire and need and connect us with people, that there's a kind of openness to a flow if you have the guts to do it. I mean, I don't quite have the guts to do it. I've known parts of my life that have been like that. But there does seem to be a kind of affordance there in our world if you can do it.
You know, lots of people whom I admire and I think have got their lives really on track tell me how much they admire me and my courage for having left the corporate environment for this life. And it's just surreal to me, because I didn't make any great leap of faith. I didn't do it out of any sort of ideological conviction or even any sort of sense of spiritual calling. I just couldn't stand to stay there any longer. I just couldn't take it. And uncertainty and, you know, all of the risks inherent in just leaving that security, none of that was really even an issue for me. I just couldn't stay where I was anymore. But it seems that my life in a lot of ways, particularly judged by the standards of mainstream society, is really broken. I mean, broken in a lot of ways. And I go and I talk to people and I stay with people who have healthy working marriages, people who have managed to put away money, people who have health insurance, you know, people who have a retirement plan, and they admire me for what I'm doing, and it's just surreal.
The same thing. You know, it's very similar with my situation, and I always kind of get reminded of the story of the grasshopper and the ants, you know, how the grasshopper comes and, like, plays violin for all the ants, and they love it, but then the grasshopper has, like, no home, and he has to come in the winter and live with the ants, and I think there's, like, this weird, the ants need the grasshopper, and the grasshopper needs the ants. Right, like the ants have to be inspired by the grasshopper's freedom and like intellectual freedom and ability to bring music to them, and then at the same time the grasshopper needs a warm place to be and some food. So like they kind of take care of each other in those respects.
You know, there's a great series of science fiction novels by, I think it's Nancy Kress. The first one is Beggars in Spain, and then there's Beggars and Choosers, which to my mind is the best of the bunch. And this trilogy is sort of her response to Ayn Rand and the objectivists, who have a very black and white sort of view of who is productive in society and who is a parasite. And her position, which she takes three books really to unfold, is that human society is an ecology, and there are a variety of things going on, a variety of relationships between organisms in an ecology. And they're not so cut and dried as these are the producers, these are the deadweight parasites. Even the parasites feed other entities, which in turn, you know, cycle energy through this system, this network of living things, in a way that really plays an invaluable role. So yeah, the ants do need the grasshopper. They need somebody to play fiddle for them, because they've spent all their time being diligent and putting away for the winter.
Yeah.
So it sounds like an elaborate justification for being a bum, and I remember the scene at the beginning of Pulp Fiction where Samuel L. Jackson is talking with John Travolta, talking about how he wants to be that wandering martial arts monk, and John Travolta's character saying, "You want to be a bum."
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, So how do you see this? Like, how did your trip illuminate your sense of what's happening now? I mean, there's something about going on the road and encountering other people's actual lives, particularly when you don't know very much about them, and you just find yourself in these curious situations, and their friends come over, and you know, it's a very rich way to learn a lot in a kind of immediate and almost subliminal way about what's going on, what the pulse is, what the sense of things is out there. What did you come away with a kind of fresh insight from your voyage?
I don't know if it's a fresh insight. You know, it's kind of like your 100th acid trip. You're probably not going to have any revelation on that trip that hasn't occurred to you at some point before. But if it's been 10 years since you had one, it's good to check in. And I really like to just get up in front of a live audience and look people in the eye as I'm talking to them. There's an energy that feeds back from the audience. And, you know, I recorded every presentation that I gave on the road. And in each one, you know, I set out to convey pretty much the same information. But because of the feedback from the crowd was different, each event was different. And, you know, I've got a book out, which I should probably flog at some point. And it's a book that I didn't exactly write so much as just transcribe, because it is transcripts of conversations that I've had with people. And I find that when I write, if I just sit down at a keyboard and I write, this ideological and sort of strident voice comes out. But if I'm talking to somebody, particularly if I'm face-to-face with them and I'm responding to their nonverbal cues, you know, I just take a much more sort of diplomatic and easygoing tone, which I can then transcribe, and it comes out in print. And so a lot of what I was doing was composing in front of a live audience, which is something that, you know, I really enjoy. So it's not that I was getting insights or learning anything about myself, just that I was doing a particular sort of work that requires other people, you know, their physical presence to do.
That's a wonderful phrase, composing in front of a live audience, because I know it very well. I mean, I do a lot of public speaking, and I don't prepare very much, and I'm not quite as eloquent as you in terms of, I'm very impressed. You mentioned taking, you know, speech lessons, and your ability to hold your own in the midst of a conversation is very impressive. It's clearly a great skill, but it's a skill that we don't really recognize as being as productive, as rich, as necessary as we do with writers, for example. You think of someone who's, oh, they're a good writer, they're putting out their op-eds, they're putting out their books, whereas somebody who's just a good conversationalist, it's like, yeah, talk show, whatever, not as big a deal. But that's part of what I mean about the subtle revolution of the podcast, is it's also a return to conversation. And conversation is incredibly important, and it's very undervalued in our society. We're not taught to converse well. We don't have often a kind of culture that supports it. You know, families have their meals quickly. People are, you know, always interrupting themselves with their devices. There's school, but it's not really a conversation. And for me, a lot of insight, a lot of real connection, and a lot of, you know, sort of art is found in conversation. And I've had the same kind of experience as you when I've given talks, and because I don't prepare very well, you know, there's an element, even though I kind of loosely know where I'm going, there's a good deal of spontaneity, and not to sound pretentious, there's an element of whatever jazz to it, of there's a kind of improv, and occasionally I find myself saying things that I had no idea about, that I was like, God, that was pretty good, who came up with that? But what I've found after doing this for, you know, 20 years, is that it's incredibly dependent on the nature of the audience, even if they're not asking questions. Even during the part, like, you know, I'll take questions at the end, but even during the main part of the talk, if they are receptive, intelligent, curious, and peculiar, then the talks are amazing. But I've done talks that I was very confident about in front of, like more academic audiences, people who were kind of hostile, who were bored, who were tired, those kind of situations. And I wasn't very good. I mean, it's really incredible how much it is a kind of collective composition, even if you, as the speaker, is on paper the main person who's producing things. So I was.
Well, it's really interesting that you're talking about that, Eric, because I've been doing these shows where I'm the oracle, you know, and I've just been going into them totally cold, and it's kind of I think, only working because it's a mystery right now, but I've been opening for rock bands in bars where people are expecting to see music, and I go up as the Oracle, and I just say I'm like the Oracle of Delphi, and please ask me any questions about the nature of the universe that you might have. And so then, you know, I just say that I'm opening myself up completely, and then it is a total dialogue where people will ask me a question, you know, and I get stuff like, what is the meaning of life, what is love, what's up with the aliens, and then there's all these kind of like joker heckler questions. But what I found, even though there might be people who like can't figure out what's going on because they're like drunk at a bar or whatever, even like with those people that might be the stinkers, like where you had weird experiences giving lectures, you know, to people who aren't receptive, even if there's some receptive people in the audience, it can shift like the entire kind of feeling of the room with some of this stuff. And depending on like how open you are to like opening them, like if you put up a block to someone who's being, you know, unreceptive, then it'll only like get worse. But like I found like with this Oracle thing, where if you open more as a speaker, you can just like break open their head. Like it's weird. I saw it happen in a couple of them where people's like minds were literally, you could see it happening in that moment. And I think when you give lectures, especially on the road, when there's questions that people can answer, you know, and go back and forth and stuff like that, it's some kind of weird mix of having you be receptive and like setting that tone and even being open when other people close. It's really hard to explain.
There is a certain self-defeating tactic that one can employ when you're with an audience that is unreceptive, and that is just to harden yourself and, you know, say, I don't care what energy I'm getting back from them. I'm going to go ahead and push through, and just through the strength of my personality and my convictions and whatnot, I'm going to put this lecture in their heads.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, a really, it seems safe emotionally, but it's probably not going to yield good results. So if you can stand in front of a bar full of, you know, drunk people and not resort to that when the energy coming back is not really encouraging, then wow, I'm impressed.
Yeah. No, for me, it's like I think about the there's sort of two categories. There's the challenging questions from people who are like insane, and when those are kind of fun, like,
yeah.
Can I take this one? You know, it's like, and they start off, and you're like, okay, we're going to really go there. And I love answering questions. I'm really good at like tuning into other people's, where they're coming from, and I can talk to very different types of people and establish a connection. I really enjoy like talking to, you know, conservative Christians or, you know, crazy street people, or I just like, okay, here we go, let's do it. And that side I can do, but it's the sort of, you know, arrogant, guarded, looking down their nose kind of, you know, things that I find really hard. I haven't been able to develop my foo for the cold academic audience yet. But anyway, we haven't talked about zombies. We're halfway through the show, and we need to take a break. So we're going to take a break here on Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis. We're talking with KMO from the Sea Realm podcast, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Listening to a progressive moment on the Progressive Radio Network.
What will be the impact of the Tea Party on the upcoming midterm elections? Who are these Tea Partiers? Are they really only a bunch of right-wing rednecks? Listen in every Thursday night from 7 until 8 Eastern to A More Perfect Union as your host, Bill Thompson, gets the inside stories from actual Tea Party players. Call in with your comments and questions, challenge guests, or show support. A More Perfect Union, Thursday nights, 7 until 8, only on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Thank you. Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, and I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions. Or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Meir Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Adam Kolker from the Brooklyn Jazz Underground. We're going to be hosting a weekly show every Tuesday at 5 p.m., focusing on sounds coming from the borough of Brooklyn. We'll be playing some new releases, doing live interviews, some live performances, maybe even venture out into music from some of the outer boroughs. Brooklyn Jazz Underground, Tuesday at 5, only on the Progressive Radio Network.
To PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and I'm here with Eric Davis. We're talking with KMO, and we'd like to talk a little bit about zombies. Everyone's favorite topic. For me, I've always enjoyed the esoteric symbolism of zombies, and especially I'm getting ready to do this ritual, which is all about like communion and stuff like that. And communion really is this total consumption of the flesh, right, which is super taboo, and it's a cannibalistic flesh-eating thing, which is very tied in with zombies, of course. Zombies get to kind of remain undead and come back to life, but only if they eat flesh. That's like the stipulation. They have to have blood and brains and flesh. And the way that, you know, Christians kind of are able to have immortality and everlasting life is that they have to drink the blood of Jesus, which is really kind of funny because it means that Christians are zombies in a weird kind of way. I don't know. Kim, have you ever like been confronted with that issue before?
Well, there's actually a movie called Zombie Jesus.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen the trailer. And, you know, frequently you can get the gist of a sort of ironic film like that just from the trailer. And it's basically the one Jew in some small town who has got to rescue all the Christians who have fallen under the sway of this zombie who is Christ. You know, this rising from the dead guy who makes you eat his flesh.
It's totally true, though.
Yes, indeed. There are so many vectors into the zombie archetype, so many things that it appeals to. You know, there's just the gore aspect of it. You know, people like to see gross stuff. There is the necrotic or the necrophilic or the necrophagic sort of taboo impulses that it appeals to. But there's also the survivalist. You know, people... They're doing a remake of Red Dawn. You know, the Cold War is dead and gone, but they're going to do a remake of Red Dawn because people love this idea that all of a sudden I don't have to go to work anymore. You know, I don't have to listen to the BS. I don't have to pay taxes. All I have to do is grab some guns and head for the hills and shoot people, and I'll be totally justified in doing it. Mm. And the, you know, a Soviet invasion certainly gives you permission to go and shoot people, but the zombie apocalypse turns going and shooting people in the face into a moral act, because if there's any aspect of this person's humanity left in that rotting shell, that rotting, you know, cannibalistic corpse of a shell, they would want you to kill them. They would want you to bring this existence, you know, of theirs to an end. So to the extent that you can load up on ammo and just, or, you know, get a baseball bat or a hatchet or a machete and just go and dispatch a whole bunch of people, you're being a really good guy.
Well, that's also, when we talked about before, that brought up the issue of automatism, you know, the sense of being an automaton or being driven by impulses that you don't control. And I think one of the fascinations of the zombie is that there's this kind of it's like an automatic human, a human that's running on pure programming, without a soul, without will, without decision. And in a way, that's, you know, the opposite of how we feel about ourselves. But in so many ways and from so many vectors, there's this kind of creeping suspicion that we're more like that than we think we are, whether it's looking at, you know, neurology and where does will actually happen, or the ancient theological and philosophical conversations about free will, or the sense that as we enter into this ever more network society, that we're kind of, you know, becoming this sort of ant species where we're sort of probed and constantly triggered 24/7 by all of these various, you know, media, informational, zeitgeist impulses, and that our thoughts aren't our own. And, you know, and even if you start to analyze your own thinking, even how you think, like we were just, like we were talking about with giving talks in front of people, it's like, oh wait, who thought that? That's not me. You know, so there's this sort of underlying anxiety about decision, about being a willful, self-conscious, intentional human being, and that really manifests as well in the kind of fear of the inner zombie. And I think that's another aspect.
And the zombie genre also gives us permission to indulge in elitism, the sort of elitism that is frowned upon. You know, we get to think that we really are better than everybody else because we are one of the few human survivors left, and there's this sea of figures out there that have a human shape and engage in recognizably human behaviors, like going to the mall or just going through the motions of their old job, but there's nothing inside. They have no soul. They have no aspirations. They have no sense of self or purpose. They're just, as you say, automatons. They're going through the motions, and they don't know to do anything different, but, you know, we're different, and the group of people that we've decided to get together with and face the world with, you know, we do have purpose. We do have some vitality left in us, and it hasn't totally been sapped. Although, in the zombie apocalypse, eventually all humans will die.
Well, wasn't that proven? Wasn't there a scientific study? I love that. That was...
Yes, there was a scientific epidemiological study conducted with computer modeling by a couple different universities, and they concluded that the best response to the zombie apocalypse was just to kill them all as soon as possible, as soon as it's discovered, you know, swoop
well,
in,
show no
mercy.
Well, it's kind of interesting that they use the word zombie apocalypse and just the idea of trying to kill all the zombies, because that is like in the book of Revelations with the apocalypse, that's literally what happens when everyone gets resurrected from the dead. I mean, again, with the Christian stuff, I know, but in the book of Revelations, like, and even in Judaism, actually, there's this thing in the back of your neck, your C7 vertebrae, which they call your resurrection bone. And there's this idea that at the end of times, there is literally a zombie apocalypse where all the dead rise, you know, and that's what they say. So, like, it's interesting that they don't say that the resurrected ones will consume all the sinners that are still left alive, but it's kind of interesting that there's that thing, idea that the zombies are going to take over the entirety of the world, right? And that's actually what will end up happening, and all of humanity will be consumed by it. It's kind of like an old idea.
It is an old idea, which I think is yet another vector into it. You know, it certainly plays into the Christian and Judaic end times archetypal stories, and people can really identify with that, even if, and this is John Michael Greer's rap, you know, even if you think you are an atheist or you think you are a secular thinker, you have grown up in an environment in which these apocalyptic narratives are just everywhere. You know, they completely permeate our intellectual environment, and we might not even be aware that we're attracted to them because they are so familiar and so deep-seated.
So how about you? How did you get into the zombie? Did it come out of some of your other more, whatever, political, environmental, future-oriented interests, or is it just a sidelight that you've been nursing and now has now taken you over?
I first remember, I must have been about 16, and I went to this underage club where people would gather in Independence, Missouri, to break dance. And we got to this club really early, and the DJ wasn't playing any music, but there was Dawn of the Dead playing on a big projection screen, and the sound was off, and I didn't know what it was, but there's all these zombies, you know, eviscerating people and eating their entrails, and I was just really struck by it. And I guess I saw the film in its entirety shortly thereafter, but for years I had zombie apocalypse nightmares, and it was just an endless cycle where suddenly the zombie apocalypse sweeps over the area where I am, and I gravitate to a group of survivors. We find some stronghold. We hole up there, and eventually we are either overrun just by sheer numbers and force, or somebody stupidly thinks that they can make peace with the zombies, and they open the place up to them. And the zombies are always right near me, you know, ready to bite me and turn me into one of them, but somehow I dodge it, and I escape, and I escape with a small subset of the original group, and we go off and we establish a new enclave of, you know, temporary security, and it just repeats endlessly. And so anything that I say about it, you know, to make it relevant to politics or sociology or futurism or anything like that, that's all just sort of after-the-fact justification for the fact that I'm really gripped by this imagery at a deep level.
Hmm. Well, it's a good thing to admit that. I mean, that's I think true of many of our obsessions, many of the things that interest us. And the more we know that side of it, or can tap into the side of it, in fact, it makes the sociology and the rest of it more interesting, because there is a real imaginative commitment that's been made, not intentionally. It's just something that grabs one, but it puts you in good light these days, because it really does seem that the zombie is the creature to beat for sort of mass obsession. I mean, there was, you know, the vampire, you know, is definitely in the house, and the last few years has been very good to the vampire, but at least personally it did not have the zeitgeist punch of the current zombie wave. What do you think of the AMC show The Walking Dead?
Well, as I'm sure you know, I have started a new podcast called the Z Realm Podcast. I do it with a partner. His name is Marty. He's in Greensboro, and I get to be just the talking head figure on the podcast, and he's doing all the really hard behind-the-scenes editing and podcasting work. But we were so excited by Frank Darabont taking on the great comic by Robert Kirkman that we were going to do a sort of tailcoat writing show where we were going to do one episode of the Z-Realm podcast for every episode of The Walking Dead. And now The Walking Dead, the first season, was only 6 episodes. It's over. So you know, now we're striking out into other territory. And the upcoming episode is one in which we talk about two movies that are really quite disturbing. I was just at his house just a few days ago. We watched Zombie Strippers and Dead Girl. And these are both very sexual films, very taboo films, in that they involve sex with corpses or seeming corpses. And, you know, in the Dead Girl film, there's just a lot of material that seems to be just a deliberate red flag for people of a certain, you know, politically correct bent. And it's really provocative and also quite disturbing. So that will be the next episode of the Z Realm podcast.
Ah, I see.
Well, it's interesting, though, because there is, like, going old school style. That's like a big part of Tantra, right? And there's these ghouls in Tantrism that live in cemeteries, and they consume the dead. And literally, like, if you look at, like, Tibetan Buddhist tankas, like paintings, pictures, you'll see this thing in a lot of them, which is called a skull cap, and it's the top of a skull that's like cut out, and all these different deities, including Buddha sometimes, are holding them, and they're full of brains. Brilliant. And in fact, there's this running theme in Tantric Buddhism where you visit the cemetery, and then there is like all the gory type of stuff where they, you know, do all that kind of really gross stuff. But the idea of consuming brains in a skull cap and engaging in this lascivious activity in a graveyard actually extends all the way back into the Vedas for like a couple thousand years. So when you see some kind of like exploitation movie about that, like zombie strippers, it's kind of crazy that it actually has a tie and a hook into an ancient Indian story.
Well, my friend Marty will be happy to hear that, because he can add that to his well-rehearsed defense of zombie strippers. He thinks it's a wonderful film.
That's good. We're helping him out. Now, I think it's really important to insist on those kind of connections, because, you know, on the one hand, it's sort of a goofy thing to acknowledge, but it works both ways. You know, sometimes, especially people who study Buddhism and, you know, the Dalai Lama and the sophisticated ancient system of Tantra, and they talk about these imaginations, and they symbolize everything. They say, well, like the chud practice in Tibetan Buddhism is one where you go into the cemetery or and you imaginally, presumably, whatever that means, if you don't actually believe in the, you know, ultimate nature of any physical reality, but you give yourself to the demons. You offer your body, you offer your soul to these hungry ghosts, these demons, these demonic forces.
For them to eat.
Yeah, to consume. So you're like giving yourself to the zombie in that situation. And, you know, when people read about that stuff now, they're like, oh, it's a symbol of offering the self and being liberated from desire. And you're like, yeah, whatever. But for the practitioners who are doing that, there is an element in which they are in that scenario. It is not simply that they are symbolically doing some symbolic gesture. It's that they're in a frightening, terrifying place where these entities are as real as anything, and they are nonetheless still offering their immortal souls or their eternal souls to this situation. And so being tied into that coarse, pulpy, kind of funny, kind of exciting, kind of frightening, kind of awful realm that you find in exploitation culture is also a way of keeping that part of you alive. And in our, you know, a lot of times people just, they lose touch with that, and it only comes up in their dreams. They can't integrate it. And it's part of where our source of life comes from, even in something as clearly exploitative as zombie strippers.
Zombie Strippers, by the way, stars Jenna Jameson.
Whoa.
Yeah. Wow. There you go. Well, I did want to mention, you know, as we're kind of winding up here, I wanted to give a shout-out to your book, Conversations on Collapse, which I think is a really great book for a number of reasons. One is that I think a lot of people are fascinated by this world of peak oil, of, you know, the lack of sustainability long term, and, you know, financial markets, and there are, and the environmental situation, and yet there's a certain kind of intensity and sort of extreme character to a lot of the discourse that after a certain period it sort of becomes hard to keep on it, you know, and you're like, oh, is this just a crank, and how do I weave my way between the crank and the thing that I really have to acknowledge? And at the same time, of course, there's a part of you that's horrified. You just don't want to think about it. You just want your, even though we live in a leaky boat already, you don't want to think about the fact that the leaky boat is going over a cliff. So what's great about this book and the way that you talk to people is it lets you sort of, you know, get a sense of the world and some of the characters in it through a conversational form, which, as you say, is often a lot more appealing and accessible than, you know, here's my strident perspective and on this, you know, crucial matter. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Conversations on Collapse, and to ask you also what your favorite conversation in the book is. What's the one that really you're most psyched that people are reading or have an opportunity to read?
It depends who the person is. I mean, I've got a real wonky side to myself, and for the wonks out there, I think that they will really dig the interview with Thomas Homer Dixon. But for the poets out there, I think the interview with Joe Bajant will probably appeal.
And what are those?
Well, Thomas Homer Dixon, he wrote a book called The Upside of Down. He's got some other books. One of them is The Ingenuity Gap. And his wrap is basically, and it's a long one, but in a nutshell, it is that we have grown so interconnected via information technology that now our social, or not our social systems, but our regulatory apparatus, the power grid, financial markets, systems of governance are so tightly interconnected that a failure in one that a century ago might have been an isolated event can now cascade and bring down lots of interlocking structures, so that a minor sort of glitch in the electrical grid in Ohio can leave much of eastern Canada in the dark for a week or more. Mm-hmm. And people in eastern Canada who are used to getting all of their news via the internet are suddenly without the internet, and they're lost. And part of what he has to say, I mean, he's appealing to this group of folks called the Panarchists, who are their figurehead, I guess, is a guy named Buzz Holling, and they've got this sort of ecological model for how financial markets work or any sort of complex adaptive system, such that things go through a growth phase, and then there is a phase of decay, and a new equilibrium is reached, and then in the growth phase, new forms of connectivity are established, and these new forms of connectivity, while they have immediate benefits to the system and propel further growth, they also cause the system to become more brittle and more susceptible to the failure mode, which is inevitable. And their argument is that by sustaining the growth phase, as we have done with our industrial technological society, we are making the inevitable correction all that much more severe and catastrophic, and that if we really were to operate on a sort of ecological, holistic understanding of how complex systems work, we would not be doing everything we can to continue the growth phase.
Mm.
And so, as I say, that's the sort of wonky side. With Joe Bajant, he's got a book called Deer Hunting with Jesus, and he's an old redneck who took a lot of LSD and got himself an education. And so he can speak to us, and he can speak to the Red State Tea Party folk, and appeal to everybody. And he talks about the hologram. The hologram being the system by which all of our perceptions and expectations and allegiances are managed through high-tech media. And with the hologram, it can orchestrate what Joe calls chemical seasons of the mind. And I almost always try to avoid talking about whatever is current in the news cycle, and I'm really tempted now with this WikiLeaks thing, but I'm put off by the concept or the idea of talking about what's current in the news cycle, because then one becomes a willing participant in these deliberately orchestrated chemical seasons of the mind, where everybody is instructed to be concerned about topic X right now, when in fact I think most of the topics that we are instructed to be concerned about, and mainly concerned about in terms of our opposition to some other group that we've been pitted against, all of these things are really trivial.
Right.
Compared to what we should be thinking about.
No, that's a wonderful words and a wonderful place to leave in. I actually really agree with you, although the WikiLeaks for me was one that breaks the mold in a way, because it feels so strange, like regardless of the topic or the opinion, it just, I feel the warpage of reality pressing upon me, and so I have to articulate that. But it's really only when things like that happen that I cross that line. In general, I think that's a beautiful place to be, and I think it's pretty much where we're going to have to end it. So again, check out Conversations on Collapse, transcripts from the Sea Realm podcast, which is of course still out there, so check that out. And hey, KMO, it's been wonderful. Good luck with your ongoing adventure.
My dream.
We'll talk soon, and goodbye from Maja. She had to drop out. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Eric. Take
Keep your minds open.